At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the Write Club podcast, where we take you behind the pages and into the fascinating world of writing. I'm Beth and this is Mary, and we're part of the team at Writer Magazine and Writers Online. Hi Mary, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you. Linda Newbury is our guest this week. Linda has written widely for all ages. Her 1988 debut young adult novel, Run With The Hare, was about a sixth form girl who became involved with an animal rights group. Her books have been shortlisted for the Carnegie Medal and the Guardian's Children Fiction Prize, and her 2006 novel Set in Stone, a Victorian Gothic mystery, won the Costa Children's Book Prize. Younger titles include Posy, Lob, Barney the Boat Dog, and the Cattail series. For middle grade readers, Linda has written several novels, including Nethermoor and Treasure House. Her first novel for adults, Quarter Past Two on a Wednesday Afternoon, was a Radio 2 book club choice. Linda writes and edits reviews for Writer's Review, which she runs with her friends Adele Gerris and Celia Rees. Her latest novel, The One True Thing, is out now, published by Writer's Review Publishing, which she set up as part of an author collaborative after becoming frustrated with the publishing industry. Linda, welcome. Where are you joining us from today?
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I'm in North Oxfordshire. I live in a quite small village close to Banbury.
Oh, brilliant. And is that your writing space that you're in?
Yes, I'm in one of my writing spaces. I've got various places, but this is my actual study, which is in a complete mess at the moment because I'm in the middle of shunting books around and changing things. So it's a good job you can't see the floor, because just before this interview, I realized I couldn't actually get to my chair. So I had to move things around. So it's not quite as, you know, you'd like to picture a writer in a sort of wonderfully organized study with everything in its place. And mine is emphatically not like that at the moment.
But it will be eventually.
It may be, yes.
And you wrote an article for our July issue entitled Sisterhood and Solidarity, where you talk about the importance of strong female friendships as writers and now publishers. Why do you think it's so important for writers to seek out these supportive communities, and how can they go about it?
Well, it's a very lonely profession, sitting on your own in a messy or tidy study with your engrossed in your own thoughts. And it can be quite hard to sort of keep up your morale all the time. And so I think it's important to have the right sort of community. And I suppose I made my group of writer friends, I've got probably about six or seven good writer friends who don't necessarily know each other. Some of them do, but I've met them in various ways. Some I met through a sort of informal writers group called the Scattered Authors Society. And I suppose gradually through the Scattered Authors Society, I met dozens and dozens of people, but it sort of narrowed down to three or four people who I've stayed good friends with, and we've sort of strengthened our friendship. Because they're all, as it happens, people who have written for children and are now writing for adults. And you need people who understand the frustrations and difficulties and can just sort of listen to you. I think that's really important, so that you know you're not all on your own, and people can have had similar experiences. They can, you know, advise you. We also do a fair bit of swapping work with each other, and having discussions about our work in progress, and that's really useful. So how to do it, I suppose, if anybody's just starting out, I think the thing to do would be to join a writer's group, and in that group to find the sort of one or two people who you really connect with.
And what obstacles were you experiencing in the traditional world of publishing? And how did self-publishing collaboration come about?
It came about quite slowly. I think most of us who've been published for a number of years, and that most of my friends now have been published for years and have several books out. And the publishing world is great when things are going well and you've got a new book and it's selling well, and an editorial team is excited about it. But I think all of us, all of my friends, without exception, have had disappointments as well when, as quite frequently happens, a book goes out of print quite soon after publication, and that's really disappointing. And that can happen for a range of reasons. Maybe an editor's left. The editor who worked with you on the book has now left that publisher. There's nobody left to champion it. Or, as happened to me recently, the publisher, the small publisher, was swallowed up by a bigger one, and my editor left, and again, there was nobody to champion my book. And so a lot of us have had disappointments like that, and feel that we've got good work that's been published, has been well received, but now isn't available, and we wanted to make it available again. And so we thought of Writers Review Publishing as a way of bringing really good books back into print and publishing new books too, because my novel is new. It was published in April and hadn't been published before. The other two that came out with it, Mary Hoffman's David, the Unauthorized Autobiography, and Judith Allnat's The Poet's Wife, they had both been published before. But we've got another new novel coming out later this year from the Irish writer Sheena Wilkinson, which readers will be eagerly waiting for.
Lovely. Could you tell us a little bit about your novel, The One True Thing?
Thanks. Yes, I really ought to be better at this than I am. It's set around a large country house, not a grand country house, just a large country house on the edge of a village on the Northamptonshire Oxfordshire border. And there are three viewpoint characters, and we move from the present part of the story, which is actually 2018-2019. We go back to the 1980s, 1990s, and the house connects the three viewpoint characters. So there's Jane in the present, who at the age of 27 finds herself without parents, because she's at the beginning of the novel. This isn't a spoiler because it's quite near the beginning. She's summoned back from India, where she's been on a yoga retreat, because her father is seriously ill in hospital, and he dies. And so she's without parents at the age of 27. And the will reveals that he had a son that nobody knew about in the family. We go back to Bridget, Anthony's wife, and when she first came to Wildings, to this big house, and she felt completely out of place because she'd grown up in Bedford. She came from a relatively working class background, and now Anthony has inherited his parents' house, and they've moved there, and she feels she needs some kind of a role for herself. And a lot of the story centres on the marriage between Bridget and Anthony, which is quite difficult. And he can be very, very moody, very distant, and he won't discuss things with her. And they end up sort of leading independent lives, but living in the same house. And several times in Bridget's part of the story, she says, "I can't put up with this, I must leave him." But she doesn't. And so Jane in the present is wondering what kept them together. And the third viewpoint character is Meg, a young stonemason who comes to rent an outbuilding as her workshop of Wildings. And so these are the three viewpoint characters. And so I wanted to set up sort of tensions and questions and a mystery about who this son was and who his mother could have been and so on. And in the present part of the story, Jane is completely thrown because she feels everything is up in the air. She'd been living at home to support her father, who hadn't coped well after the death of his wife. Suddenly the house has got to be sold because there's this other son and the estate is going to be divided up. The house has got to be sold, so she hasn't got her home. She'd left her quite well-paid job to teach yoga, so she's not really earning very much, and she has been having a very on-off relationship with an unreliable boyfriend, Tom. So Jane is she feels that the rug has been snatched from under her feet, and she doesn't know what her future will be. So that was a very long-winded way of telling you what it's about. I should be much better at it than that.
Oh, but there's so much in it. I mean, Beth and I have been talking about it all week because we both love it. And the three stories, there's so much in each of the three stories, and then linking them all together. I just thought it was an absolutely, I love it.
Yeah.
And I love the theme running through, which is obviously the one true thing of trying to find your passion or your sort of your flow.
Yes. Thing,
whatever it is, there's a lot of creativity in it, in the novel, which I love.
Yes, because all three of them haven't sort of found satisfaction in personal relationships, and they each of them wants something else that gives them a sort of a drive and a purpose in life.
Yeah, I thought it was really cleverly written from that aspect, and it really did keep you the time jumping really did keep you kind of not wanting to put the book down. So yeah, I thought, I mean, we both really enjoyed reading it. But how did you come up with that concept? Is there any sort of parts of your real life that you've drawn into the book, or is it all completely come out of your brain?
I suppose I've used things that I know about, and I know quite a lot about gardening. I'm not an expert like Bridget becomes. I'm not a yoga teacher, but I know quite a lot about yoga. And the stone carving, I did have a go at stone carving. I really wanted to actually follow up my previous book set in stone, which was set in Victorian times, but involved a stone carver. And I wanted to do more about carving stone because it's so fascinating. And at once I thought of having this young female stone carver, Meg, and I wanted her to specialise in letter cutting. And so I had a go. I met a local stone carver and did some workshops with him. And I especially wanted to have a go at cutting letters, which is so exacting and so beautiful when it's done skillfully. So I had a, you know, very clumsy go and hacked out some letters, but I did sort of learn enough to feel that I could write about it and sound as if I knew what I was talking about.
Yeah, I thought the imagery in the book from that sense was you could tell that you knew what you were talking about, because I could picture the Wildin's garden, I could picture the grounds, like all of the imagery in the book. I could just see it like it was a TV program or a film. I could just picture everything.
Yeah. Oh, that's great to hear. Thank you.
And I read that you wanted to be a writer from the age of 8 and became a secret writer, hiding the stories that you'd written in your wardrobe. Why did you feel that you had to keep those a secret?
Well, I think there is something a bit secretive about being a writer, and I still am secretive. I don't like anybody to see my work until it's finished and ready. So although I said with my writer friends, we swap work sometimes, but I never do that till I've actually reached the end of the first draft. I want it just to be in my head and it's mine, and you know, I do feel secretive about it. If my husband comes into the room while I'm working, I'll quickly close down my screen and so that he can't see what's on the screen. So yeah, I had that sense of secrecy, I think, from when I was young, that it was the writing was mine, and it was quite different from the writing I did at school. I did what I had to do for school, but I always had the sense that I'm a writer and my writing is for me. And so I was always at it from that early age.
Wow, that's amazing. And you qualified as an English teacher in a secondary school.
Yeah.
Were you still writing during this time? And when were you able to pursue it full time?
Yeah, I think when I first began teaching, I was actually trying to write poetry. I wasn't spending enormous amounts of time on it, but I thought that poetry was what I would write. And then I changed to fiction. So I began writing and being published while I was still a full-time teacher. And for several years, I used to write a first draft during the summer holidays. I can't think how I did that now, because it takes me far, far longer than that. But I used to sort of, you know, day one of the holidays, I'd be there writing, and I had quite a strict regime about it. I would write every day and try to write a certain number of words every day and have a first draft by the end of the summer holidays, as well as preparing my teaching and, you know, reading the next A-level texts and all of that. So I can't imagine how I used to do that, but I did for several years. And then I went part-time teaching, and then I was able to give it up altogether and concentrate on the writing.
Could you take us inside your creative process? Do you plot everything meticulously, or do you let the story unfold as you're writing it?
Thanks. Well, I certainly don't plan everything meticulously. I like to think of starting with ingredients, and I spend quite a long time before I write anything down at all. I'm just sort of starting to think, well, there's this character, Meg, who's a stonecarver. Well, why has she arrived where she's arrived, and why is she so secretive, and who's she going to meet there, and what are they like, and what's going on? And I'm sort of just asking myself questions, really, like that. And then gradually, I think what's really important for me is I want a strong sense of the place. And so I'm so pleased with what you said, Beth, because that's exactly what I want. I like to feel really grounded in the place and have a sense of the atmosphere I want. And I suppose as regards the plot, I will usually, as the ingredients sort of mesh together, I will have a sense of, okay, there's going to be this big thing and this big thing and this big thing, but in between I really don't know what's going to happen. And actually, I don't want to know everything, because a lot of it does grow out of the writing. And I think the best things grow once you're stuck in, you know. I think it's a different part of your brain that gets to work somehow. And I just could not sit down and write a sort of itemized plan that included everything that was going to happen. It just doesn't work out like that for me.
I think it seems really, it feels like that would be how you wrote it, I think, because the characters really developed and grew, and, you know, we got to know them on such a deep level, I felt.
Oh, thank you. I think one thing that did grow like that was the friendship between Meg and Adam, which really became very important. It's almost the most important relationship in the book, I think.
Yeah, none of the romantic relationships are the important ones, are they?
So yeah, I quite like that. People might expect a happy relationship at the end, a happy romantic relationship at the end, but I didn't want to go there.
What is the best piece of advice that you've ever been given by another writer?
Well, yes, I've thought about that. And I think one of the best pieces of advice is from Stephen King, who says, he's talking about inspiration, because, of course, writers do get asked about inspiration all the time. And he says words to the effect of, yes, I do feel inspired, and I make sure I'm inspired by turning up at my desk every day. And I think that's so true. And I think a lot of writers will tell you the same thing, that you don't just sort of sit around thinking, do I feel inspired today, or shall I go and do something else and wait till inspiration strikes? I think you get the inspiration by putting in the effort. And so I think that's a very good piece of advice.
Yeah, I think that can apply in all walks of life, can't it, as well? Because you take like a standard day job in the office, whether you're inspired or not, you've got to turn up to work.
Yeah.
Do your job. So as a writer, you don't have that kind of boss telling you that you've got to be here at 8:30 and you've got to finish at 5. You have to have that initiative to work on your own, otherwise, you know, it's not going to get done. You're the only person who can write it, so
exactly, yes, nobody else is going to make me sit down certain hours, so only I can do that. Yes.
Yeah.
And can you tell us what's next for you? Are you working on a new book that you can tell us about?
I am, yes. I've got another novel well on the way. I finished the first draft, and I want to get back to work on that later this year, and maybe it'll be published next year. And for that one, I've partly gone back to my first book, which was about animal rights, Run with the Hare, which you mentioned. And the animal rights, animal campaigning is very important to me. I do a lot of that all the time. And I thought, well, I really should get back to that in fiction. And so, like this book, it moves back and forth in time. And the central character is Alice, who's an artist and an art teacher. And she has a daughter in her late teens, Rowan, who becomes an animal activist. And so it's got a sort of three-part structure like this, because we've got Alice in the present, Alice back in the past with a traumatic thing that happened to her during her student days that she's never really got over, and Rowan and her animal activism. So that's what I'm working on now, and I need to do a bit of hands-on research for Rowan before I complete the first revision.
Have you got a name for it yet, the title?
I think it's going to be called The Hide.
Well, I'm very excited to read that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye out for it. We always end by asking for a book recommendation. Have you got one for us?
Well, I have, and I'm going to talk a bit more about Stephen King's On Writing, because I know it's so important to many writers. And I should, sort of full disclosure, I have never managed to read to complete a Stephen King novel. I've started and I just don't like them. But reading this book, I feel I like him so much. He comes across as so genuine, so generous. Obviously, he's very confident in what he says, but he doesn't come across as at all arrogant. And he really wants to share all these tips, all this experience, all this great advice about writing. So for anybody listening who is or wants to be a writer and hasn't read Stephen King's On Writing, I would say go and get yourself a copy straight away.
Oh, brilliant.
We mention that in Writing Magazine quite a lot.
Oh, you do? Yeah.
Yeah, it's one that people come back to again and again.
Yeah. Yeah, it's worth rereading too, yes.
Oh, brilliant. Well, everyone will have to go and pick that one up then. Thank you so much, Linda. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you, and we really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come on the Write Club.
Well, thank you very much for reading my book and for having me on. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the Write Club. We hope you enjoyed this episode and feel inspired to keep writing. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter at Writers Online, your go-to for writing tips, competitions, and exclusive updates. Plus, you'll never miss an episode of the Write Club. Until next time, happy writing.